Good afternoon, everybody. Please be seated. This is the what we used to call the northern panel of the Supreme Court, Justice Mark Gibbons, Justice Nancy Sata, me, Michael Cherry. And we do rural cases, Washoe cases, and overflow Clark County cases. And we try to accommodate Clark County attorneys by coming down here instead of having you come to Carson City. So the case that we have this afternoon, our first case, is case number 53035, Lift Certification Company versus Thomas. Mr. Kirschman for the appellant, Mr. Thusen for the respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Norman Kirschman, and I represent Lift Certification Co. I've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. And what I'd like to do to keep this thing as simple as possible is to track for you Mr. Wayne Thomas's conduct vis-a-vis American Equipment Incorporated, which commenced in or about February of 2006. Mr. Thomas was contacted by the Las Vegas manager of American Equipment, and she inquired as to whether he was comfortable where he is. His initial comment was, well, everything's all right, but within a few more telephone calls, spurred along by Mr. Zimmerman, who was the owner of American Equipment, Mr. Thomas and Mr. Galen Powell, the vice president of operations of American Equipment, had a meeting at Lyft's offices, such as they were, and their facility. By facility and offices, I don't intend to convey the thought that this was a large facility with a large complement of employees. Truth of the matter is, there was a business manager, as they called her. It was Wayne Thomas, his son, a service tech, and one other service tech. So there was four people. I submit that the decision of the district court, and I have nothing but respect for Judge Earl, but made a serious omission in its decision. And that omission had to do with a cardinal issue in the case. The relationship between Wayne Thomas and American Equipment was pretty much treated by the trial judge as an at-will employee, and the duty of loyalty of an at-will employee. What is omitted from the decision in the detailed colloquy was that a year before the meeting at the Lyft offices, Mr. Wayne Thomas was provided with a memorandum signed by Kathy Dielman, which appointed Mr. Thomas as the Vice President of Operations for the Northern Office of Lift Certification. And if we look at the analysis that Judge Earl made, he drew a very bright line between a fiduciary, the standards of a fiduciary, as opposed to the standards of an employee. And he concedes that depending upon which state we're in and the restatement, that the distinction was not clear-cut, and that the terms employee, duty of loyalty of employee, duty of loyalty of a fiduciary have been used interchangeably by the courts. But nevertheless, Judge Earl went out of his way to say that based on the evidence that he's seen, Mr. Thomas was not a fiduciary. The implication being that a fiduciary has a higher standard of loyalty. The second problem with the decision is that Judge Earl, in his decision, made a point to talk about an incident in 2005, approximately a year before American Equipment became an issue. And he said, in effect, that Lift Equipment repeated what it did in 2005, which was by hiring Mr. Thomas away from a company called Crane Services. And he didn't say anything negative about it, but he failed to point out that Mr. Thomas, while he was employed by Crane Services, was a salesman and a service tech, having no supervisory authority, no management position, and clearly not a fiduciary. And there was no issue as to whether his leaving Crane Services to take another job was perceived as a disloyal act at that time by Mr. Thomas. And more's the blame that he put on Lift Certification. Now, 10 years before, a much lower ranked employee, I've never quite understood the relevance or the probative value of it. That I think is an error in the decision, because the issue became so close that Judge Earl basically said that you could condemn Thomas or you could condone what Thomas did, because Lift Certification was not a well-managed company. Mr. Thomas said quite clearly that he was the boss of the Sparks operation that he hired. He fired. He signed purchase orders. He had authority to purchase materials. He had extremely good relations with the customers. And so in the final analysis, Judge Earl said, it's a close question. And because of these other things, because of the fact that the company from time to time was on a COD basis with its suppliers, was from time to time, Mr. Thomas used his own credit card in dealing with the customers, and he was not authorized to sign checks, but he was authorized to sign commitments by Lyft in respect to the purchase of goods.
Before, I know that you want to reserve time, and I don't want to take it up. The matter of attorney's fees was also raised. Did you wish
the matter of attorney's fees was raised. There was briefing and a hearing on that issue, and American Equipment and Thomas had made a offer of judgment for $15,000. Judge Earl felt that that was not made in good faith, and he denied that offer. But then, I forget the number of the NRS.
18010.
I think it's 18.
010. Mm-hmm.
And they proceeded under NRS 18, and Judge gave them $50,000. They were asking $160,000. And his rationale was that although Lyft had the right to file the suit, as the case progressed and the evidence came in, because there were two motions for summary judgment filed by the defendants, each of which was denied. But he said that Lyft had no reasonable basis to continue with the suit. And that knocked down the $160,000 to what he thought was a fair return. But his rational basis in respect to the motion for attorney's fees runs a collision course with the struggles that are so apparent in coming up with approach to the key issues. And I think that there was a period of time between the motion for attorney's fees and his decision in order. And I'm not here to criticize Judge Earl. Have I run out of time?
No, you still have 2 minutes and 15 seconds left.
Okay. Well, the other things that occurred were in February, there was further contact by American Equipment with Thomas by email, and the emails can be seen on the appendix 6-7-07 KW. The emails make it pretty clear that American Equipment was going to hire Mr. Thomas. And he cooperated with them in the most critical way, is he put together a strategy for a May 1 start date for the new company, for the new American Equipment, and that that the strategy was adopted by American Equipment. Not just one more, I hope I don't run over, but if I do, penalize me with the rebuttal. There was a letter. There was a letter sent out to very, very good customers. Respondent takes the position that Wayne knew all those people. There were 50 or 60. There was a letter generated. It's hard to tell when because it had no date. And in cross-examination of the typist and of Mr. Thomas, no one could explain to me why it didn't have a date. I asked questions whether the computer might be a source to finding the date, and et cetera, et cetera. And the way the record stands is that they just forgot to put the date down. I think I've exhausted my time.
Yes.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
It pleases the court. My name is Sean Thewison of the law firm of Holland and Hart, and we represent the respondents in this case, American Equipment and Wayne Thomas. There are really two principal issues in this case. The first is what duty an employee owes its employer in Nevada. And of course, the district court determined that an employee owes his employer a duty of loyalty, and that duty in this case was not breached by Mr. Thomas. And therefore, we'll be asking the court to affirm the trial court's decision in that case. The second issue involves the award of attorney's fees. And we'll be asking the court to affirm the trial court's award of $50,000 in attorney's fees under NRS 18010. But we will be asking the court to reverse the trial court's decision that attorney's fees should not be awarded under the offer of judgment, and ask that the trial court be instructed that in this case, attorney's fees should be awarded under the offer of judgment. First, with regard to the duty issue, in Nevada, in the White Cap case in 2003, there's some dicta that talks about an employee duty of loyalty, and that language was picked up by the federal district court in Tulsa Homes in 2005, and the duty an employee owes its employer in Nevada was defined as a duty of loyalty. In this case, Judge Ural, after the case was submitted after trial, did an exhaustive research throughout the country of what this duty is called. Is it called a fiduciary duty? Is it called a duty of loyalty? And what he found was, and what the court finds was addressed in the briefs, is that in some cases it's referred to as a fiduciary duty of loyalty, a duty of loyalty. But in every case across the country, that duty, no matter what it's labeled, is the same. The duty is that, and there's three things that the trial court focused on, that an employee is not to solicit customers while they're still employed. They're not to solicit employees to leave en masse, especially key employees or employees that are under contract. And they're not to take trade secrets or use confidential information. But in every instance, the courts around the country have recognized an employee can make preparations to leave its employer and even compete. In this case, the trial court correctly defined that duty and, under the Whitecap case, labeled that as a duty of loyalty. And the reason for that is that Judge Earle believed that there should be a distinction made between the label of a fiduciary duty and a duty of loyalty, which a fiduciary duty is a higher duty that a employee would not owe its employer. The duty of loyalty, however, every employee in Nevada, at will or regardless, would owe its employer. And so the trial court did that analysis. The fiduciary duty that that Mr. Kirschman speaks of, I believe, is the fiduciary duty that an officer may owe a corporation. And there was some reference to this in the brief and again in oral argument today that the trial court below omitted a discussion of what duty an officer may owe. And that just simply is not the record that we have below. If you look at the complaint, the amended complaint that are contained in the record, this has always been an employment case. A duty an employee owes an employer. And of course, it is the appellant's, the plaintiff's burden in the trial court to prove that if there was another duty that was owed, a fiduciary duty as an officer, that there be evidence to demonstrate that he was an officer. That would, of course, mean that there would be a board resolution appointing him an officer. He'd be listed as such on the Secretary of State. He'd be referred to as an officer. He'd have the duties of an officer, such as check signing. And the evidence, the facts determined by the trial court in this case, were that Mr. Thomas, when he worked for Lyft, was a manager, that he didn't have check signing authority, that he could hire and fire employees, but that he reported to the officers of Lyft, not that he was an officer. And throughout the from the beginning to the end of the case, Mr. Thomas has always been an employee of the company, not an officer. And simply because there is this one piece of paper that was talked about at trial that I guess changes his title to Vice President of Operations does not confer upon him the status of being an officer for the corporation. There simply was no evidence below presented that he was ever an officer, nor was he treated an officer. So the issue before the court, before the trial court, and again before this court, is what duty does an employee owe its employer in Nevada? And Judge Earle, of course, found that that was a duty of loyalty, defined that, and found that there was no breach of that duty by Mr. Thomas. And I think the facts are amply set out in the decision of the trial court. There's no need to go through those. I do want to hit on a couple things that Mr. Kirschman had said. There's talk about a meeting between American Equipment and Mr. Thomas early on. That meeting was of some discussion in the lower court, and it was made very clear, both in testimony and again in the decision, that meeting occurred solely between Mr. Powell and Mr. Thomas. There was no other employees of Lyft involved. In fact, the lower court made a point to point out in its decision that Mr. Thomas was very careful to testify that he did not solicit employees before he left. And that the first time that the other employees for Lyft found out that he was leaving was right before he submitted his resignation. He didn't solicit anyone, and the other employees asked if they could come work for American Equipment after Mr. Thomas had left. And in fact, the trial court below points out in its order that several of the employees testified that had they not gone to work for American Equipment, they would have left Lyft because of the poor financial shape that Lyft was in at the time. I think Mr. Kirschman talked about some of those things. Mr. Thomas wasn't getting paid his bonus checks on time. They were having to use their own personal funds to buy supplies and things to actually run the business and service the customers because of the financial position of the company. So it really comes down to a label of the duty, because there, I don't think there can be any question that the trial court got the duty correct and what those aspects, elements of the duty are. I guess what Mr. Kirschman takes instance with in this case is whether you label it a fiduciary duty or whether you label it a duty of loyalty. And to Judge Earl, I think it was important to label it a duty of loyalty to distinguish it from a fiduciary duty. And I think he's right in wanting to draw a very bright line between those things to make sure that a fiduciary duty and a duty of loyalty that an employee owns his employer are two different things and not commingle them, so that an employee, an at-will employee, would owe its employer some fiduciary duty that would be akin to that of major corporate officers, the attorney-client relationship, something along those lines. And so he wanted to make sure that it was clear that he's talking about a duty of loyalty and not necessarily a fiduciary duty. And he was simply using the language that this court used in the Whitecap decision in 2003. Just briefly touch on the aiding and abetting claim that is a little bit part of the appeal. The trial court found that because there's no breach, there wasn't any need for him to go any further. So unless this court were to find that the duty is somehow different or there was a breach, that part of the decision should also be affirmed. So we'll move on to the attorney's fees aspect, which Justice Sada touched on earlier. And we, of course, are asking the court to affirm the trial court's award of $50,000 under 18010. And in this instance, the Judge Earl found that there were claims brought by the appellant that were not founded in a reasonable basis, and that American Equipment was forced to expend resources to be able to defend. Specifically, the one he uses as an example is there is the allegation in the complaint and the amended complaint carried throughout that Wayne Thomas and other employees for American Equipment were receiving payoffs or money from American Equipment before they left Lyft to siphon customers away from Lyft to American Equipment. And Judge Earl was very clear in his order that even though this issue was investigated by the appellant, that there was no testimony from anyone, not one customer, not anyone else, to support that allegation. And so what he found is that claim, that allegation, had no basis, was unreasonable, and therefore under 18010 he had grounds, discretion, to be able to award attorney's fees. And that, of course, is discretion that is given to him clearly by the legislature in the statute that says that attorney's fees should be awarded in all cases where the court feels it is appropriate. And of course, the standard by which this court then reviews Judge Earl's decision is again to give deference to the trial court to make that decision. So we believe that at least that portion of the decision should be affirmed. The respondent also requested attorney's fees under an offer of judgment. After about a year into the case, an offer of judgment was sent from the respondent to the appellant in the amount of $15,000, and there was some settlement discussions. And of course, an offer of judgment is a basis can be a basis for an award of fees in this case, because the respondent was a prevailing party and did beat that award. What the trial court Judge Earl said in his decision was that he was going to deny the award of attorney's fees under the offer of judgment because the offer of judgment was strategic in nature. And of course, as I'm sure the panel is aware, that all offers of judgment are strategic.
Did the judge do a Beatty versus Thomas analysis of the factors?
He did not. I think he, in the order, in the decision, he touches on what some of those are, but he doesn't go through an analysis. What he says is that he makes his decision. He believes that because the offer of judgment was strategic in nature, that he therefore was not going to award fees under the offer of judgment, rather than going through the Beatty analysis. And although not in the decision, if you go through and read the transcript of the hearing, which of course is in the record, Judge Earl actually says that the offer of judgment was not made in bad faith. He says that during the hearing. But what the decision is that The amount of the award of, or the amount of the offer of judgment being $15,000, because the demand by the appellant was so high, he didn't think that that amount was going to do anything to get the case resolved. In essence, the two sides were worlds apart.
Well, isn't that one of the Beatty factors, though, the amount and how, you know, what it's done? I mean, you have to evaluate that.
And that's correct. The amount and the time, whether they're reasonable in the amount and time. And Judge Earl doesn't go through and say that the amount is unreasonable. He doesn't say that the timing of the offer was unreasonable. All he says is that the offer was strategic in nature, that it was made as a litigation tactic. And of course, an offer of judgment is a litigation tactic. You make an offer of judgment to something that you believe you're going to be able to, as a defense attorney, beat, so that it puts pressure on the other side that if they don't beat that award, they're going to potentially have to incur your fees. And that's the reason why you have this, the offer of judgment rule in statute. And that's, I'm sure, one of the reasons why the offer of judgment was made in this case. But Judge Earl never goes through and says that the offer at the time was unreasonable. He just simply says that it was strategic in nature. I believe something that should be addressed. Obviously, $15,000 in this case, Judge Earl pointed out that he did a case or nationwide research on the case law to decide what the standard was, and that it was only after this exhaustive search that he was really able to determine that. Well, that was something that was done by the attorneys early on, the investigation into such as the allegations that Judge Earl uses to actually award fees, that he found there was no basis. Those investigations were done. The respondent felt comfortable with its case and made the offer of judgment to put the pressure on the other side to get reasonable, to come try to get the case resolved. And at that time, as the record points out, each side had about $30,000 in attorney's fees. So the respondent was willing to walk away from its attorney's fees and pay $15,000, which would have been approximately half of the fees and costs for the other side, to get the case resolved. The appellants made the decision not to accept the offer of judgment. And then, of course, the fees went up because you had several motions after that. You had a trial. And so now you have $160,000, and you have the respondent asking for that through the offer of judgment. Just to sum up, we're asking the court, again, to affirm the duty and that issue that was addressed in the district court, to affirm the award of attorney's fees, but to also reverse and ask the district court to award fees under the offer of judgment.
Any further questions, Justice Sata, Justice Gibbons? Thank you. Thanks to both counsel for their arguments in this matter. This matter will stand submitted. You used up your time, Mr. Kirschman.
5 minutes.
No, you used up your time.
Oh, use up your time.
I'll give you 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
2 minutes.
Okay. Aiding and abetting. Aiding and abetting could not survive an exoneration of Mr. Thomas. And so that was an automatic. There's a statement made in the decision that you can't have a fiduciary if that fiduciary is an at-will employee. No citations, nothing substantive, and it's flat out wrong. You've got some high-level executives all over the world who are at will. The authority that Wayne Thomas exercised, with the exception of not being able to write checks, he had it all. He ran it all from start to finish. Conduct of Mr. Thomas, he was obviously their supervisor at the very least, and he never instructed the other three people to not to take any property of the company when they left. Finally, the three people who had never been instructed to leave Lyft's property intact did questionable things. the office manager downloaded her computer and then deleted everything on the hard drive. Mr. Thomas's son had what he's, I think it's Mr. Thomas's son, had his own personal calendar. Calendar for what, where he was supposed to be and with whom he was supposed to work, and he considered that his property. The other fella, pretty much the same. So, thank you for the time.
Well, thank you. Thanks to both counsel. Panel thanks both counsel for their arguments in this matter. And this case will stand submitted. We'll be at ease.